And good morning, everybody. Glad you're with us on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. Just a week after signing the bill that created Medicare, on August 6, 1965, President Lyndon Johnson signed a law that made it illegal for states and local jurisdictions to impede the voter registration process and deny the right to vote to African Americans. Here's part of what President Johnson said at the signing ceremony.
Today is a triumph for freedom, as huge as any victory that's ever been won on any battlefield. Yet to seize the meaning of this day, we must recall darker times. 3.5 centuries ago, the first Negroes arrived at Jamestown. They did not arrive in brave ships in search of a home for freedom. They did not mingle fear and joy in expectation that in this new world anything would be possible to a man strong enough to reach for it. They came in darkness and they came in chains. And today, we strike away the last major shackle of those fierce and ancient bonds.
President Lyndon Johnson on August 6, 1965. This morning, a conversation about the history of the Voting Rights Act and the future of voting rights as we celebrate this historic milestone and assess the consequences of the 2013 Supreme Court decision that struck down one of its central tenets. I'm joined in Studio A by two scholars from Baltimore who have studied and written about these issues extensively. Taylor Branch is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the iconic history of the civil rights movement, America in the King Years. F. Michael Higginbotham is the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law and the former interim dean at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Gentlemen, welcome. Good to see you both.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, Mike Higginbotham, let's start with you. Do you agree with President Johnson? He was certainly aspirational when he said that that this law would strike away the last major shackle of those fierce and ancient bonds of slavery. But 50 years hence, has that happened?
Unfortunately, it hasn't happened, but I do agree with President Johnson that it was a monumental achievement in the history of freedom because its impact was tremendous. Over 800,000 new voters were registered within 4 years of the passage of that act. And in Mississippi alone, the percentage of registered African-American voters went from 6% to 66%. And so it was a tremendous act that did much to help to get to freedom. But unfortunately, we're not there yet. And I know we're going to talk about what's happening today.
Was there anything about the legislation itself from a legal perspective that you think was flawed, something they could have fixed at the start?
Well, I think what you're dealing with in terms of the Voting Rights Act, of course, is a conflict with states' rights. And that's been a huge deal since Reconstruction in our country. And the Voting Rights Act, when you look at the history of the 15th Amendment passed in 1868, which said there shall be no race discrimination in voting, unfortunately, states were able to do things like literacy tests, poll tax, grandfather clauses, which basically made that 15th Amendment's promise nil. And so the Voting Rights Act was the first time that the federal government was able to pass legislation under Section 2 of the 15th Amendment to really give teeth to Section 1, which said no discrimination. So when President Johnson says it was significant, yes, it was. But the problem was, of course, it created conflict with states' rights. And that's been, I think, with us, and we're dealing with that even today.
And Taylor Branch, bring us back to the scene in the summer of 1964. On the 2nd of July, the Civil Rights Act passes. And then just a few months later, in December of that year, Dr. King is awarded the Nobel Prize. And then from January of 65 through what's known as Bloody Sunday in March, tell us what was going on in the South at that time and in the country in general.
Well, the Nobel Prize marked a new phase in Dr. King's career because it was the epitome of the campaign against segregation, which had been 10 years since the Brown decision finally gotten a law, a federal law outlawing basic segregation in the South. And Dr. King surprised his staff by saying, we're not going to celebrate or even work on implementation of this for a long time. We're going right to Selma to work on voting rights, which is even more fundamental. He had promised some of his staff members he was going to undertake this campaign to answer the Birmingham church bombing, which had happened in 1963, that until black people could vote in Alabama, you were going to have this sort of unanswered crime. And so he went there in January, straight back from the Nobel Prize. It really did mark a turning point in him as a prophetic leader, pushing forward to the next item on the agenda of what freedom really meant.
On the 7th of March, 1965, Dr. King was preaching in Atlanta, but a march took place, began from Selma, and the intention was to go to Montgomery. What happened on that day, which has become known as Bloody Sunday?
Well, that's been celebrated at last in the breakthrough film Selma this past year that was nominated for Best Picture that the state of Alabama repressed and attacked and tear gassed and beat the marchers on Pettus Bridge, causing a national and international reaction for that matter that went all around the world because it was shown on television that Sunday night. And so that became the first of three attempts to march from Selma to Montgomery and finally it was successful by the end of on March 25th, 1965.
So on the 15th of March, 8 days after Bloody Sunday, President Johnson called a special night session of Congress, and he pushed for a voting rights bill at Dr. King's, after Dr. King's advocacy and others. Here's part of what President Johnson said to Congress in this extraordinary session at night, just a week after Bloody Sunday.
What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
We shall overcome. Taylor Branch, what was Dr. King's reaction to hearing that, a phrase that President Johnson invoked about halfway through a 44-minute speech?
Well, he teared up. He was watching it in Selma with most of his staff. I think he expected a good speech, but I don't think he expected a speech as sweeping as it was. Right from the opening sentence, I speak tonight for the dignity of man and the destiny of democracy. It's a truly remarkable speech that is sadly lost to some degree right now because Johnson is such a flummoxing figure in American history. We don't realize what a shining example he was on fundamental issues like voting.
Mike Higginbotham, the legal landscape of 1965, you mentioned that there were precedents dating back to the 1860s and 70s, the three so-called Reconstruction amendments to the Constitution. But talk about specifically the kinds of things that Southern states in particular were doing to repress black people from voting.
Well, it's a very sad period in our history because there was so much hope after the Civil War, when the amendments were passed, Reconstruction amendments were passed, and a great deal of civil rights legislation was passed under President Grant's administration and the radical Republicans in the Senate and House. But what transpired was very disappointing Supreme Court decisions, beginning with Strouder versus Virginia, where basically the Supreme Court said that states couldn't specifically pass laws to discriminate on the basis of race, they could regulate voting in terms and jury participation in terms of age, and other requirements, such as, and this is what happened based upon those other requirements, literacy tests, grandfather clauses, poll taxes, where states were able to, and general criminal code, states were able to target certain crimes. And as a result, there was a tremendous disproportionate impact on the basis of race. And that's what happened with Strouder versus West Virginia. As a result of that, the level of black voting participation in many states in the South was less than 5%. And so that created tremendous problems, and that's why you really needed a Voting Rights Act, because you had Supreme Court cases that said states could pass these laws that weren't specifically mentioning race, but had a tremendous disproportionate impact.
All right, we're going to take a break for a bit and then come back and talk a lot more about this. On 881, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, we'll have more on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. We'll talk about the Supreme Court decision 2 summers ago in which the so-called preclearance formula was invalidated. And we'll talk about Governor Larry Hogan's veto of a bill that would have given convicted felons the right to vote before they completed their probation or parole. More with Taylor Branch and Michael Higginbotham after a break for the news. Stay with us. On 88.1, welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now we're going to continue our conversation about the Voting Rights Act with the historian Taylor Branch and legal scholar F. Michael Higginbotham from the University of Baltimore Law School. Tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the day that President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. In June of 2013, the Supreme Court ruled that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act was invalid. This is the part of the law that required jurisdictions to undergo certain pre-clearance measures before their voting laws were changed. So, Michael Higginbotham, tell us what the intent of Section 4 is, what the result for Section 5 ended up being, and the reasons that the Roberts Court gave for overturning it.
Sure. Voting Rights Act prohibits race discrimination and other types of discrimination in voting. And there's 5 sections in the Voting Rights Act. And Section 4 sets up a preclearance standard where the Justice Department has to approve of any states or counties that are covered under Section 4 has to approve any changes in their voting practices that may have a negative impact on racial minorities and others. Section 5 is the provision that identifies the formula for states that are covered. That's what in Shelby County, in the Shelby County case, that's what was struck down, the coverage formula. And basically what the Supreme Court said in a 5-4 decision, a very divided court, Supreme Court said that the coverage formula needs to be updated. It's been too long and things have changed. I got 3 problems with the decision. One, I think it's wrong on the law. I believe that a lack of deference was afforded to Congress, a co-equal branch, and the Supreme Court has always said appropriate deference should be given to a co-equal branch. 2006, Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act. They held hearings, and 99-0 in the Senate, 333-30 in the House. Basically reauthorized the Voting Rights Act and said it was necessary in 2007.
So, and they reauthorized it for 25 years.
Exactly. And so the Supreme Court basically didn't give them the proper deference. But I also think it reflects a lack of objectivity on the part of the court. It's a 5-4 decision. 5 Republican appointees basically struck it down. 4 Democratic appointees upheld it. So I think it undermines the objectivity of the court in that respect. It politicizes. But most significantly and most problematic, I think, is that to me it disrespects those Americans of all colors who fought and in some cases died for people to have the right to vote. We're talking about, you know, people like Viola Louisa, a white woman from Detroit who came down to honor Dr. King's request of people to come down and help during Bloody Sunday, during the March on Bloody Sunday. And so I think it's disrespectful to those individuals, and certainly we need to reauthorize that Voting Rights Act, and certainly it needs to be upheld.
And, of course, this involves certain jurisdictions, many of which are in the South, but some of those jurisdictions include Brooklyn, Manhattan, and New York. I mean, they include various places around the country, and it simply means that if they're going to change the voting procedures or the voting rules, the Justice Department has to okay it, has to just give
it. That's the preclearance, and it's a really powerful provision to basically say, look, states, you can't change unless the Justice Department approves it, the federal government approves it. And it's interesting, the coverage formula, because as you mentioned, people are shocked that some counties, New York, some Brooklyn is covered, some counties in New York are covered. It's not just southern states. It's not just the old Confederacy states. But the reason for that is when you look at what the Voting Rights Act said, it said states that have literacy tests in 1965. It said states where there is less than 50% of individuals registered to vote in minority groups. Those states or those counties will be covered. So that's why you get Alaska. That's why you get certain counties in New York covered, because they satisfy that formula. And it's really, really problematic not to reauthorize this Voting Rights Act. It really is, because if you look at what's happening today, you have, you know, voter ID laws, you have limitations on early voting and same day registration. These have the same impact as literacy tests, poll taxes, and grandfather clauses had in the past. They may not have the same intent. We can debate the intent of these laws. But clearly they have the same impact, and that is very problematic in terms of the cornerstone of our democracy.
And Taylor Branch, of course, race is at the heart of this. You've done a lot of thinking about race. Matter of fact, you're conjuring up a possible book about this whole notion of what we mean by race and racial and post-racial. Justice Roberts is basically saying in the majority opinion that times have changed, that we are now in a post-racial society, and we need to have rules that that comport with 2015, not 1965. Do you see any evidence, you know, of us being a post-racial society the way that Justice Roberts sees?
Well, there's been tremendous racial progress, but at the same time, whenever anybody says that anything in politics is not about race, it's usually a pretty good sign that it is, because race still underlies and drives an awful lot of American politics. There's no other force in American life, for example, that could cause the two major parties 50 years ago to swap places on the race issue. The Republicans, who had been the party of Lincoln, 80% of them voted for the Civil Rights Act in 1964 in both houses of Congress, but a year later, they start to switch behind Goldwater. And Democrats, who had been the party of white supremacy in the South, solid South, when I grew up in the South, there were no Republicans. They were scarce. It was the solid Democratic segregationists. And as soon as Johnson endorsed these bills and signed these bills into law, the Democrats became the party of civil rights. So race drives our politics, and it still does. There's just an awful lot of dissembling about it.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. Taylor Branch won the 1989 Pulitzer Prize for Parting the Waters, the first of his three-volume trilogy called America in the King Years, which is considered the seminal history of the American Civil Rights Movement. By the way, last month, it was announced that in October, the National Archive Foundation will give Taylor Branch the 2015 Records of Achievement Award, which recognizes individuals whose work fosters awareness of history in the United States. Congratulations on
that.
Mr. Branch. Also joining us is Professor F. Michael Higginbotham. He teaches law at the University of Baltimore Law School. He's the author of Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. So, Mike Higginbotham, John Lewis, Congressman Lewis from Georgia, is trying to get a vote in Congress to update, essentially, the Voting Rights Act to the current conditions that Justice Roberts mentioned in his decision. Speaker Boehner is insisting that it go through the Judiciary Committee, the chair of the Judiciary Committee, a guy named Chairman Bob Goodlatte from Virginia's Republican, is against the bill, and he's decided not to take it up. Congressman Lewis is trying to get it straight to the House floor for an up and down vote, but it appears to be stalled. Is it your recommendation that the Voting Rights Act, as it existed in 1965, be renewed, or is it in need of a little tweaking and updating?
I certainly don't have a problem with tweaking and updating. I think when Justice Roberts said circumstances have changed and the voting rights needs to be updated, I think if you look at recent elections, clearly there are some states and some counties in the North, such as in Ohio and Pennsylvania, where problems have existed in our presidential elections and in our state and local elections. So I don't have any problem with updating the formula. In fact, perhaps it needs to be expanded to Ohio and Pennsylvania and some of these other northern states. But I do think that it's really important for us to make sure that we stand up for our democracy. We should be encouraging individuals to participate. I went to South Africa in 1994 for the election of Nelson Mandela, and they had three-day elections. They had people who had never voted before in their 80s and 90s waiting in line for a day or two to vote. And they had over 80% of their electorate voted. We need to be encouraging that. We need to make sure that our democracy works and encourage people to participate. So there are a lot of things that we could do, including an updated Voting Rights Act, that I think would help our democracy, not hurt it.
Anchorist Taylor Branch, voting rights is one thing. Voting is another. In the last general election, less than 37% of the registered voters in the United States actually participated in the election. The general election turnout since World War II has been, miserable in many ways. What are some of the strategies that people could enlist to increase voter engagement and engagement with the political process in general?
Well, ultimately it's the people's job. There's a lot of complication in these formulas and so on and so forth, but it's all quite simple. It's what do we mean by we the people? If we the people is the foundation of our government, do we take it seriously? And the fact that our voting participation has gone down and that there have been all sorts of subtle things to discourage voting is a bad sign for a democracy that rests on we the people. So voting is what the founders meant when they said we the people. Was a lot more people than have governed in the past, because it was a monarchy. So they were moving toward what we aspire to today, which is all the people. And that's really the basis of our patriotism, and we lose it in the weeds a lot when we don't have a lot of participation. So we all need to be encouraged to figure out ways to make we the people real.
Michael Higginbotham, Governor Hogan vetoed a bill that passed overwhelmingly in the Maryland legislature that would have allowed felons to vote as soon as they got out of prison. Maryland had one of the most progressive laws on the books about felons' rights in voting, in that it allowed, since 2007, it's allowed ex-felons to vote once their probation or parole is completed. This bill would have allowed them to vote the minute they got out of prison, even if they were still on probation and parole. Many felon disenfranchisement statutes are sort of state-specific, but is there a common thread in that? And what do you think the argument for allowing felons to vote is? The governor simply says that not being able to vote is part of your debt to society.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, when you commit a crime, there are certain penalties that can be imposed. But once you have done your time, perhaps we should have you reengage in society, and certainly voting is one of the ways that can be done. There are three approaches. One is sort of you get the death penalty in sense of when you commit a crime, you can never vote again, period, even when you're released from prison and reengage. Then there's another approach where you can vote even while you're in prison. And a number of countries and a few states do that. So there are various approaches. And then the other approach, which we had in Maryland, is once you serve your time and get out, you can vote. I think it's important that we allow individuals, after they've served their time, to reengage in the democratic process. And that means once they serve their time and get out, we should allow them, without too many hurdles. And one of the problems is there are tremendous hurdles in states in terms of being able to exercise that voting right after you've served in prison. So we need to relax that rather than increase it.
Michael Higginbotham is the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. His latest book is called Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Taylor Branch is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 9 books, including The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. He's currently working with David Simon, Ta-Nehisi Coates, and James McBride on a project to bring his King trilogy to the screen in a 4-part HBO series. Gentlemen, I very much appreciate your being here this morning. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Let's conclude our discussion about the Voting Rights Act by listening to part of what Dr. Martin Luther King had to say when he addressed the crowd in Montgomery, Alabama at the end of the Selma to Montgomery March on the 25th of March, 1965. This was the march that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act 5 months later.
I know you're asking today, how long will it take? Somebody's asking, how long will prejudice blind the visions of men? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment,
yes, sir,
however frustrating the hour, it will not be long, because truth crushed earth will rise again.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long?
Because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long?
Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne.
Yes, sir.
Yet that scaffold sways the future.
Yes.
Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. How long? Not long. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Yes, sir.
Martin Luther King addressing the crowd at the end of the march from Selma, Alabama, to the state capital in Montgomery, Alabama, on March 25th, 1965. President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law 50 years ago tomorrow. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. More ahead. Stay with us.